Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Today we are going to get some penultimate answers to the big questions about 2025. Usually what we like to do is take the last 2 days of the year to reflect on the year we have just experienced from a Catholic perspective. And here to help us do that, we're going to run through the big Catholic stories. We're going to run through stories that the media should have covered if they thought like we think. We're going to talk about the person of the year. Maybe we'll talk about the Catholic person of the year, and then we'll get into what Catholics need to do in 2026 to make the world to teach the world to sing or whatever. I don't know how to make the world a better place.
Buy the world a Coke.
Yes, that's right. Here to help us, that was Todd Agliolaro, the director of publishing here at Catholic Answers. Todd, welcome.
Hi, Si. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Why? Thank you very much. That's right. And also with us, Edgar Lueno, the assistant to the hosts here.
Technically, I'm just the producer today and not not assistant host.
Thanks, Edgar, for being here. Mm-hmm. Did you both, I just want to get your qualifications on this. Did you both live through the year 2025?
Barely.
You barely lived through it? I'm so sorry to hear that.
I spent more time awake in this year than I did in any other year of my life.
Yeah, this is the most awake you've ever been.
Yes.
Because of Emilio Maguire.
That's right.
Your Emiliano, new best friend. Yeah. What did I say?
Emilio.
Oh, Emiliano Maguire. I beg your pardon. I got your child's name wrong. Okay, so there's impressions that come with years. Like I would say my impression of the year 2020, just for example, that was a bad year. At the end of the year, we were like, that was a terrible year. So I'd like to start with general impressions. Do either of you have any feelings about this year? Good year, bad year, indifferent? What do you think? Nobody got anything.
You know, they all kind of blur into one when you get older, Si.
That is true. So it's good in the sense that you're still here at the end
still
of it.
Still here,
then.
Made it through, richly blessed and all that, but I haven't quite been able to reflect as to how I'd characterize
it. All right, but I'm going to say that's neutral then.
All right,
if you don't come right out with a, it was bad or it was good, then I'd say, meh, it was a meh. What about
you? I would say it's a blend of both, but for me, in general, there's more positive than there is negative, even though there's a lot of negative in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually thought, given the years that we've had since, I don't know, let's go back to the year 2001. That was a bad year. If I just did the average year between then and now, I'd say this was a pretty good year. This was one of the best years we've had in the last 25, I thought.
That's fair. At least in the last five.
Is last five?
Have they? Been? I would say at least the last five. This has probably been the
now
best.
This is, now you're getting so specific. I don't know. Like 2020, I remember that. 2008, I remember really bad. I just feel like
I know. I graduated high school in eighth grade. Or eighth grade.
Yeah, you 2008. Graduated high school?
In eighth grade, yeah.
In 2008.
2008.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Came out and there was no jobs.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's fun.
Well, anyways, okay. So here's what I thought I would do. What we like to do is poll our listeners each December to ask them, what did you think were the big stories of the year and all that? And I found a shortcut this year. I found a way around that. Everybody's getting replaced by AI, so I replaced our audience with an AI. I asked ChatGPT to do all the work this year. Part of that is because it was crazy busy around here and I just didn't have time to get it out. Darren had a kid. Darren and Rena had their sixth kid, so he was out for a bit, and he's usually the organizational force in my life that makes me get the things done that I'm supposed to get done. So he not being here was a bummer for the poll and all that. But here I asked ChatGPT the top five Catholic stories of 2025. You guys ready to go through ChatGPT's view of the top five Catholic stories of 2025?
Hit us.
All right. number five. I'm actually going to switch the order of four and five because I don't want to start on a complete bummer. I realize like Luke will be in there. Why are you starting on such a negative story? Here's a great positive uplifting story. Pope Leo the 14th met with King Charles the 3rd. There's a big story for you.
Yeah, it's a story that, if you're into Catholic apologetics and its history, kind of pings you, because we haven't had a king of England in a lot of our lifetime, so we've got a king
now. Oh, that's right. Man, many people lived and died without a king.
Yeah. And right. The king is, the according to the Church of England, the head of the church in England.
Yeah.
And so we have a historic animosity there. And yet they made nice. And so it almost makes you wonder, does that old conflict even matter anymore?
I wonder as well. I mean, Queen Elizabeth had the reputation, and I always liked her Christmas message, and I'll listen to Charles's Christmas message this year. I have not yet listened to it. But I always liked her Christmas message because she would talk about Jesus Christ, you know, like in using the faith, using the faith terms around him and all that. And so I always liked that because I felt like Queen Elizabeth was a genuine Christian. I don't know about Charles. Charles, he doesn't make a public confession of Christianity as far as I can tell. So it's weird to me that you have almost a post-Christian leader of a Christian church in Charles. And maybe that's, in a certain sense, when religion doesn't matter anymore, religious conflicts don't matter anymore.
I don't know much about King Charles, but my experience of the Queen comes from the show The Crown. So that's all I really know. And that was the history for me. So what I note from that and bits and pieces of history that I've read, she really took her job as duty as queen as a very serious thing.
Yeah.
And she recognized what it means to be selfless and give herself in all ways that she can to her kingdom, I guess you would call it. Compare that to King Charles. I don't really know too much about him, but the way the show portrayed him doesn't look to be like a very virtuous human being.
Was this a Netflix TV show?
Yeah, it was.
Because you know Netflix, like, that slightly offends me.
Okay, but
that you but rely that's, on
I'm telling
Netflix.
You. So I'm telling you, I'm coming at it from a millennial perspective who doesn't know part of that history. But the parts that I found interesting and did my research on, he seems very different from his mom.
Oh, yeah,
and
definitely.
His approach to the crown.
Yes.
Well, he's a post-Christian leader of church nominally, and he's a post-modern kind of ruler. He makes his preoccupations with climate change and a lot of the
architecture. I do. That's one thing I like about him. He's totally into architecture.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he seems to be kind of an NGO head or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Not a faith leader.
No, and not really a ruler of a realm either. He's a figurehead. But I think that it's only a good thing, even if it was more as a head of state, that the Pope met with him rather than as a religious leader.
Right.
I doubt they were talking about, you know, doctrinal differences in there.
But I don't think, like, even today, I don't know the law in England today. We're going to talk about England, Great Britain in general, a little bit more later when we talk about religious intolerance, but they're making the list this year. But I don't think Charles, like, say Charles had a conversion tomorrow and woke up and said, the Catholic Church is the true church, I need to be Catholic. I don't think he could be king anymore, could he? Wouldn't they tell him he's done as king?
You know, I've heard that said about other nobles who converted. I don't recall their names right now, but I've heard it popularly said that put them out of the running for succession, yeah.
But if he is the head of the Church of England, wouldn't that, and he says, I'm converting and I'm bringing the whole church with me, can he do that? Or is that just not on the table?
I think that's not on the table. I don't know. I mean, it's
because what would it take for the Church of England to reunite with the Catholic Church?
Well, pastors have done that very famously over the years.
Oh, yeah, right. What was the famous deacon who did that? No, he became a deacon. Now it won't come to me because I'm trying to.
You're not talking about the one who died in the motorcycle accident? He never became Catholic.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay, it's somebody else.
But we have seen that. We've seen pastors come in with, usually not with the whole flock, but sometimes with a good percentage of the flock will make that. And often I think that's rooted in study, that the pastor begins to study with his flock. And as they're studying, they begin to realize, oh, this Catholic thing has a compelling kind of argument, and it has a compelling, it's drawing them. And so a lot of times when the congregation comes in with the pastor, it's because it's a shared study that they all did, And they're like, I think we might be Catholic. And in they come. And that's perfectly fine. You can do that. And usually bishops are quite solicitous of that.
I was at a conference last summer, and there was an Anglican clergyman there who half-jokingly, half-lamentingly said to me, sometimes it feels like we're just shepherding them until they become Catholic.
Really?
There's a kind of inevitability maybe to faithful, high church, high doctrinal content Anglicans, that they kind of have an inevitable date with Rome. Sheldon Van Auken felt that way, if you recall.
Especially with Anglicanism, the high Anglicanism, it almost is like an arrow pointing you towards the Catholic Church. Like, and there are many wonderful saintly Anglicans and have been throughout the centuries, but they belong in the Catholic Church. It was a odd quirk of history that they even left the Catholic Church, and they belong in the Catholic Church.
Can I ask you guys for some speculation?
Yeah.
With the great schism happening within the Anglicans right now.
Is that right? Schism or schism? Which is it?
I'm not weighing in on this one.
Because you know which way the boss goes. Is that right? He gets mad at everybody who says schism. Go ahead.
With the great schism
that's
happening, what do you think is going to happen with the more high church Anglicans? Do you think there's going to
be schism within
Anglicanism?
Mostly in Africa you're talking about, I think?
Well, with the election of this, what is it, the Archbishop of Canterbury?
Archbishop of Canterbury. A lot of people, there does seem to be a breaking of communion in Anglicanism, similar to what happened in Methodism a few years ago, if I understand it correctly, which it does seem to break around the response to the sexual revolution.
Yeah.
That frankly just seems to me, the sexual revolution was devastating to the Catholic Church, but it's terminal for some of the Protestant churches, especially some of the mainline Protestant churches. They just never came up with a unified response. I think help me out if you think I get this wrong, but I think John Paul II helped the Catholic Church respond to the sexual revolution with this kind of clarity, with some of the Veritatis in Splendor and some of the other encyclicals. Whether you would say any particular of his was right on the money or he was off, there was a general direction that we're not abandoning the traditional stuff. And that meant that in the Catholic Church, you either accepted it, what the Pope said, and went forward with the Church, or you left. So I think there was a kind of schism of just, there was a withering of people who really wanted the sexual revolution to revolutionize the Church, just didn't find a home in the Catholic Church in the 80s and 90s. And so the thing kind of muddled through without a split.
Well, I certainly agree about what John Paul II did with the theology of the body and love and responsibility and
yeah, thank you for helping me with the things.
Well, love and responsibility is my favorite of all his works, and it's a masterpiece. But I disagree with you that the dissenters to his teaching just went away. I mean, they certainly stuck around the woodwork.
Yeah. Yeah, but we don't. It does seem to me that, like, why did the Methodists split over sexual issues? Because I think if any fair analysis would say, the Methodist Church would not have split were it not for the sexual issues, because there's no authority there to say this is the definitive thing.
Well, with the Church of England, which we were talking about, you go back to Lambeth in, was it 1930?
Yeah,
and that if you want to go to a watershed moment,
terrible error.
And the rift that it opened has just widened. So when you ask Edgar, is this a schism or a schism or a schism, as I think Jimmy used to say? I didn't mean to embarrass him, but he used to say schism. I think he's been corrected of that since.
Really? Really? Yeah, that sounds like...
I mean, there are two letters after the S. You probably should say them in some way or another.
You have an argument. He's like, I'm not weighing in on this. And then when he weighs in, it looks like, oh, I've been thinking about this for 20 years.
Couldn't hold it in any longer.
Dropped a bombshell.
But back to your point, Edgar, I don't think this is that S word. I think this is a long, slow train. I think it's just a long, steady decline. To quote a famous Anglo-Catholic, it's going out with it, not with a bang, but a whimper.
At the heart of it, though, is those who desire to stay faithful to Jesus through all the changes since the sexual revolution of the 20th century, they're building bridges with one another. And what I mean, it sounds judgmental to say you want to stay faithful to Jesus, but Jesus is very clear on his sexual teaching. It's not really hard to figure out what the Bible teaches as far as sex goes. So, and to pretend otherwise is to pretend. That's what I think about it. It does seem to me that, okay, now you end up with people, a lot of Christians looking at each other going, well, who have kind of persevered with the traditional Christian teaching, with the teaching that goes back to Christ on sexuality, and they're looking at each other going, maybe we should all be in the same church. And I think that that's happening. I'll let you comment on that if you want when we come back, and we'll continue with the major Catholic stories of 2025 right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
This is Monsignor Arthur Calkins. I'm so grateful to have this opportunity to speak on a Catholic radio station, which is so necessary for all of us to strengthen our faith. This is a great task of evangelization, and we thank God that Catholic Radio is available in order to do so.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We got a lot of stories to cover, and we're stuck on King Charles met Pope Leo XIV this year. We're doing the major Catholic stories as decided upon by me and my best friend. That's literally what it came down to. My best friend and I, we sat around and talked about this, and you know who my best friend is.
Croc?
Nope, not Croc.
No,
I'm ChatGPT, and I think I'm one of those people that, like, the one I start with is the one I'm going to finish with. Like, I'm one of those...
AI monogamist.
I'm an AI monogamist. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Have I introduced you to Gemini yet?
But no, I've talked to Gemini. That's okay, Adam. Look, enough with the metaphor. Pope Leo, King Charles. Anything else that you want to say? What do you think of my idea that the sexual revolution is the number one issue that the Church has faced over the last 100 years, and those who pass the test, so to speak, are looking at each other now going, I think maybe there's not as much that should divide us as we thought.
You know, people have called this the ecumenism of the trenches.
Okay.
And you see Protestants and Catholics and even interfaith on the sidewalk in the morning at the abortion clinic or working in defense of marriage. And these are all sexual areas, and bringing them together. And that kind of common moral cause thawing some of the iciness of faith differences.
Yeah, one hopes. One can hope. All right, here's another one, and I let ChatGPT talk me into this one. The Archdiocese of New York announced that it settled for $300 million clergy abuse claims. I think this is the second or maybe third settlement from the Archdiocese of New York. Most dioceses are on their second or third settlement. I just wanted to include this one at ChatGPT's suggestion because I think we're still suffering through this.
I haven't known a church that's not involved in scandal in my life. So
no.
What's the first one that really came out, I think, was a Boston Globe back in 2002. So when I started paying attention to what was happening in the church, it was all of this. So this is all I really know. And it honestly, I know I share this sentiment with a lot of people my age, is that you lose a lot of hope in the church, just all the constant payout money. And then, you know, the ministry appeals and all this, it's like, you know, this money's going to go to the diocese. And it's like, well, we kind of know where some of it's going. And Yeah, it so makes you not want to donate. I was like, well, I know where this is going for the crimes committed by certain people, and why do I have to participate in that? That's the initial knee-jerk reaction to those requests. So
it does. Go ahead.
Well, every one of these is a punch in the gut, and it fills you with sadness. Now, the thing to be saddest about, of course, in all of these stories is the physical and spiritual harm done to the victims of the abuse. Secondly, you got to say that it's the harm done to average Catholics whose faith is shaken and who become cynical or whatever. But we don't talk enough, or we don't talk as much about another kind of harm, and that's the squandering of the material wealth of the church. And that wealth was built up by generations of poor Catholics, of immigrant Catholics in this country, of people who gave from their poverty to buy land, to buy, to build church buildings, to create ministries. And all of their sacrifice and all of their far-seeing vision is just being trampled upon every time we write a check like this. So it also makes me mad.
I feel mad at it in this regard. It does seem to me that as much as both of you acknowledge the victims, and you very rightly should, the Catholic Church is not the world's primary sexual abuse locus. I mean, the billions and billions of dollars that have been sucked out of the church by people who will not look at the institutions they're a part of. The hypocrisy of it at this point I don't even know how to describe the emotion of it. It's tiring, the hypocrisy of it. Far more people have been abused in the public schools of the state of New York than ever were. And now people hear that, and I know there's self-righteous people who go, "Well, are you downplaying?" No, you're being self-righteous. I'm clearly not downplaying anything. None of us have downplayed anything. The point is, this is a fetish now of the media and state officials, and it's your fetish. It's not my fetish. The church has admitted her wrong, has done everything she could to correct it, and as long as there's been schools, kids have been safer in Catholic schools than in any other school. So stop lying to yourselves. At this point,
an important arrow for a defender of the church to have in his quiver, to point out rates of abuse in the Scouts or public schools or any other institution where wicked adults have access to children. At the same time, the church has a higher standard. And I think it's a testament.
Is it 300 million higher? A billion higher?
Well,
how much higher is it? Like, I'm not saying we don't have a higher standard. I think the church is living up to her standard in her apologies, in the way bishops have responded, bishops who are not guilty of these things, the way that she has settled these suits over and over and over again. I think we're living up to our standards now. I don't feel ashamed of that. I feel like there's a point at which this is just people who they happen to get a hammer in their hand and they're just going to keep swinging.
Well, the money's a big part of it. I mean, we live in California where a year or two ago you couldn't turn on any screen without seeing commercials from the sex abuse version of Ambulance Chasers saying, the statute of limitations has been extended by 5 years. And that's the state of California trying to bankrupt the church, and it's bankrupted many dioceses. So there's a lot of greed involved.
Twice, for some dioceses in California, twice the state of California. While the state of California, if you actually talked about liabilities, if we could really, in our crystal ball, see what are the liabilities that people actually have for sexual abuse, the state of California would be hundreds of times worse than the Catholic Church. But it doesn't open the statute of limitation against itself. An image has been created. People feel self-righteous about it. Are there victims? We've said yes a million times. There's victims in your family. There's victims in your Kiwanis Club. There's victims in your school. Are there victims in the Catholic Church? Absolutely. Sexual abuse is endemic. It is part of the human condition. And at this point, I think it is just clear that states like New York and California, their intention is to bankrupt Catholic dioceses about every 10 years. And that's what they're going to do. That's the policy of these states. And it's just something that we're going to have to live with.
Well, the church is the rival to the state. So there's political philosophy behind this too.
I know a lot of these political leaders are people who we oppose because they're in favor of euthanasia and abortion and gay marriage and all these things that we oppose. So I think they're right to keep attacking us. If you look at it in a pure Machiavellian way, they're right.
And it's a stark reminder too, isn't it? It's a stark reminder to us. And it maybe it recalibrates our outlook on being in but not of the world. Maybe
I think that's a very good point. Yeah. We'll leave that one there. The three top Catholic stories of the year coming up. See if you can guess what what ChatGPT and I agreed were the top three Catholic stories of the year. ChatGPT, which, by the way, took about 6 months to figure out that Pope Leo was actually the Pope. Do you know that story?
I don't.
All right, I'll tell you when we come back on Catholic Answers Live. Why do Catholics pray to dead people, bow to statues, venerate relics? And where do we find any of this stuff in the Bible? In the delightful book, The Saints Pray for You, Dr. Carla Broussard convincingly defends the ancient Christian belief rooted in Scripture that the saints care for us, that they're our allies. Order your copy of The Saints Pray for You today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Okay, so this is the thing with ChatGPT. If like in July and August and September, you asked ChatGPT about Pope Leo, ChatGPT was not sure if Pope Leo was a real person or not and would tell you all kinds of things like Francis is still the Pope. And then it would get confused and go, well, there does seem to be this other figure, but it would twist itself because it seemed like it was trying to keep itself from hallucinating a fact, and somehow it was not integrating that Leo was the Pope, and so it was a state of a contest for a while.
It's a state of a contest.
It's a state of a contest AI for a while. But the report, the definitive report on this was written in the. Catholic News, it was a Catholic News Agency or Catholic Register, National Catholic Register. I think it was National Catholic Register published it, how ChatGPT just would not accept Leo as Pope. It would not accept Leo. All right, here's a big story, and you're going to be like, what? How is that a big story of 2025? This is a big Catholic story. There weren't a lot of Catholic stories, by the way. I didn't think it was a big Catholic news year, except for, of course, our number one story, which everyone can guess what the number one story is going to be. but it didn't seem like there was a ton of Catholic news. In the tradition of the dog that didn't bark, maybe, I'm not sure exactly how to categorize this one, Synod on Synodality. It ended in 2024, and now we are in the implementation phase. I would say the most remarkable thing about the Synod on Synodality is how little we have heard of it in 2025.
I had to go to ChatGPT to help me formulate an answer on this.
And what did ChatGPT say?
ChatGPT said, oh, really?
Have you seen anything on Netflix about it?
Or? Not yet. I think they're making a documentary about it now.
Synodality?
The ending doesn't have, the final act doesn't have a big bang, you know? Well, you know, everybody talks about the Synod on Synodality. Depending on which circle you're in, you can either hate it or love it. I was kind of in the middle between those. I was like, you know, I understand what they're trying to do, but I don't like what they're doing. And a lot of the groups that tend to be more heterodox are trying to introduce things into the church that'll never be introduced. But I did this on the Super Show a few weeks ago. Something that came out of the Synod on Synodality had nothing to do with America, at least on the surface. It was the document that came out on polygamy.
Was that a Synod product?
It was a Synod product.
Oh, fascinating.
And I was like, we don't need this. You're right. We, in general, don't need it here in the States, but they need it in Africa. And
in one of our states, we need it.
All right, go ahead. So I think this to me was like, okay, so there's good fruit that are not, it's not America-centric. It's like American Catholic-centric. So
wait, the world does not revolve around us?
I just discovered that.
This is I'm having trouble accepting this.
So I saw this document and I was like, I see zero purpose for this. Why are you guys wasting your time? And turns out it's not. It turns out there's actually some Catholics in Africa that actually need to hear this because it's so ingrained into the culture. And now it's there for them. So
It is funny the things that you don't think of as an American that come out of the Vatican and you're like, what? What is that? I remember when years and years ago when the Charter on the Rights of the Family came out and there were certain rights that were, if you were an American, you'd look at that and go, why are we even calling that a right of the family? And it had to do with China or countries that had one child policy. When you thought outside of America, it became clear why they were signifying certain rights, like the right of the family to regulate its own size, you know, the right of the parents to regulate the size of the family. That struck many people as like, that's a weird way to phrase that, but it had to do with China. They had to respond to China. So, yeah, getting out of the America-centric view, it's not going to be easy now that we got an American pope, but has your life been improved by the Synod?
Well, I was struck by something that Edgar said. He said, I understand what they were trying to do. And that's a quote.
That's a direct quote.
Could you explain to the rest of us, please?
They were trying to listen. Were you not listening, Todd?
Because I wasn't listening hard enough.
They wanted to hear from the people, which I get, but I don't see the purpose. I understand what they were trying to do, but I don't see the purpose for it. I never saw what's the end goal. If you're going to have groups of people who are going to say, we want to see women priests and we want to see gay masses. It's like, it's never going to happen. Great, we're listening to you, but
yeah,
why?
It's funny you mention that because you see two polar sides on this. Those who are convinced that the whole synodal project is a stalking horse for introducing to the church all kinds of horrible heterodox changes. And then you have those who would probably welcome some of those changes who are vexed and angry at how slowly it's all going and how they haven't been those things coming out. Yeah. And seeing it all perhaps as a kind of false flag operation I'm out of metaphors here, so help me.
Oh, God, hold on.
just a kind of a bone being thrown to their camp to make them feel like their concerns are being heard. Well, the whole deaconesses thing that came down recently incensed a lot of the barely hanging on Catholic left that wants to see women admitted to holy orders, like for example in Germany.
Yeah, but there it does. I had the feeling my sense of the synodality was it was not a means that could achieve the ends it was designed to achieve, and that endless listening sessions and all of this stuff. It couldn't get the church where it needed to go. And I haven't surrendered that. I wasn't, like a church that listens and welcomes people from the margins and all, like all that is so good. I just didn't think a synod was the tool that could accomplish that. And I remain convinced of that. And I think we have not had a pope take seriously in the modern era the reform of the parish. And the parish is where the church happens. And we've got all these giant documents on every issue under the sun, but where is the pope who's just going to say, look, the parish is struggling horribly around the world. We need a new image and model of how the parish works. We need to get this thing going. And it's, I mean, some of what the synod was about getting rid of clericalism. Well, do that at the parish level. Fix the parish. I mean, why is the pastor of the parish running a parish without a finance council or a pastoral council, as they do in many places? Well, that's clericalism. And we need to have parishes that take seriously the idea that the people need to be in partnership with their priests way more than we have thought of in the modern era. We moved out into the suburbs and nobody changed the model of the parish. So I feel like what Pope Francis wanted was a church that's listening and goes out to the margins and welcomes and has hospitality and all that. I don't think a synod is the way you get that. I think talk seriously about what's going on at the parish level. Why are parishes failing to do what they're there to do? And let's get going. Let's go. Let's daggummit.
Sorry for Pope.
To quote Philip Rivers, daggummit, let's go. So I think it missed the mark. I think the whole thing missed the mark. And I think if synodality is about all these things that Francis said it was about, I just think he chose the wrong tool.
I've worked for two diocesan chanceries in my life, and I could say one thing I learned from working for both of them is that in a diocesan setting, probably as in a government setting or in education, process is super important.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if outcome in this case is less important than simply kind of journeying together and doing it. And you get the feeling you've accomplished something simply by having walked along, even if you don't arrive.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's that's called bureaucracy, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, like that's when the bureaucracy takes over, process becomes more important than progress. Which is, I think, always the free market argument, isn't it? That, like, if you leave it up to government, say, to build a rocket, it just won't do it as well as Elon Musk or one of these billionaires.
Yeah, it'll come up with 9 committees to design a tail fin.
Right, because of bureaucracy, mm-hmm. because bureaucracy will get in the way. All right, well, moving on. You know what? Let's take a break, and then we'll do the top two. We'll do the top two news stories, Catholic news stories of 2025, according to, well, the experts, me and ChatGPT, right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with the gospel message. EWTN is the most trusted source of authentically Catholic content on the air today, 24/7, television, radio, social media, and podcasts. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I don't like to reveal what goes on behind the scenes, but Edgar thinks Todd's being too irenic. Edgar wants you to throw more flames.
You know, it's a little bit like that story of Saint Therese who hated one of her fellow Carmelites so much that she tried extra hard to be nice to her.
Yeah.
And they had to break them up because they got too cliquish. They were. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you don't know that story.
I didn't know it got that far.
Yes.
Therese.
So sometimes I'm too ironic because I'm trying so hard to be ironic.
I think Edgar felt, now I don't want to judge what you were saying, but
go ahead.
I think you felt Todd would be more negative about the synod on synodality.
No, not necessarily. I want him to be a realist about the synodality.
I have a hotter take primed right now that ChatGPT helped me come up with. So,
okay, what did ChatGPT help you come up with on the synod and synodality?
No, not on the synod, on one of the future topics we're going to
talk about. Oh,
really? Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. It's getting juicy. I like
it. You can always cover yourself in what ChatGPT told me to say and then just drop a bomb. Catholic story number two. I'm not sure if I picked right on this. It should have been Matt Frad went to the Daily Wire, but I picked Pope Leo went to Turkey and Lebanon.
That's massive.
And came home alive. What? That's not funny to you?
That he came home alive?
Yeah.
No, I'm very grateful. Why would you joke about such a thing, Si?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were going to be. It was Scold Todd that came in here today. The most interesting thing about this whole thing about Pope Leo going to Turkey and Lebanon, and God bless him for going. You know, there used to be the heartland of Christianity used to be Turkey. Are we all aware of that? Oh, I wonder what happened. I'll have to go back and look at the history books, try to see if I can remember what happened. So Pope Leo went into the Blue Mosque, not the Hagia Sophia. I pronounce the H. Is that wrong? The Hagia Sophia?
Well, it's a breathing mark in Greek, I think, right? Hagia, the little cedilla over the H. Over the A.
I knew he would know. So am I supposed to say it or not? Am I supposed to say Hagia or Hagia Sophia?
I say Hagia.
Hagia Sophia. He didn't go there. He went to the Blue Mosque, which was... what's the difference between not stolen and the
and that was funny, Si.
That was.
I affirm it.
But he didn't pray at the Blue Mosque, and recent popes had prayed in mosques. And then when he got back, somebody said to him, "You know, why didn't you pray at the Blue Mosque? Because there's nothing wrong. You can pray anywhere. As a matter of fact, you're supposed to pray everywhere. There's not a rule. You can't pray here. You can't pray there." But he said a very odd thing, I thought. I'm not exactly sure what to make of it. He said, "I prefer to pray in Christian churches."
That's not a strange thing to me. Why would that be odd?
Well, go ahead. Tell me what you...
You don't prefer to pray inside of a church?
Well, no. I suppose it struck me as... something a modern pope might not say in that, like, I prefer to pray in a Catholic church because I know Christ is there.
Yes.
But
it's a bit uncomfortable when you're in a house of prayer for something that's not your faith. Many moons ago, I dated an Indian girl and she was Sikh. And I was like, well, it was Sunday. I was like, well, I want to take you to church. And she said, only if you come to the temple with me. I'm like, okay. Very awkward, very weird, specifically because when you walk in there, there's a section for women and a section for men. And I sat there and it's like...
And you were like, best church ever. But no, not really.
But, you know, you go in there and she goes her way and I go my way and I'm just kind of sitting there and everybody's looking at me and like, I feel very awkward even praying to my God here. This is a little strange. I don't know what to do.
Plus they all had knives.
The guru is up front kind of like giving me the eye. And it's like, what are you doing here? Clearly, I didn't fit in. She told me I looked Indian because you got to put a little – men have to cover their head in this thing. So I put on the bandana. But I was wearing a suit. And everybody's there is in like jeans and a T-shirt and just sitting in their temple. And here I am in a suit, barefoot, and this orange bandana on me. It's like – I kind of don't feel comfortable right now, and I don't want to pray.
Because I don't feel comfortable with that mental image of you, to be honest with you, Edgar.
Actually, I want to see a photo of this. I would love to see a photo of this. Can we put it in the thumbnail for this?
I can't say I blame the Pope not wanting to pray there.
I loved how wonderfully American Pope Leo's answer was, as it was reported, when the... is it an imam? Who was
the imam, yeah, that was given him a tour, yeah.
And asked him if he wanted to pray. And his reported, quoted response was, "That's okay."
He said, "That's okay."
He said, That's okay. Which is so American and so Midwest. I thought that was beautiful.
That is very American. That's okay.
No, I'm good.
No, I think what he's making a distinction there, and it seems to me. I mean, and maybe he's not teaching anything. Maybe that's just how he is. But it seems to me that because there's nothing wrong with praying. There's nothing theologically wrong with praying wherever you are. The fact that he didn't, and then the fact that he said, "I prefer to pray in a Christian church," it suggests to me that he has a little bit of an agenda there, which is to refocus people on the uniqueness of Christianity, to not let it just syncretize with other religions.
Yeah, I think that does suggest that. He made other comments at other points in his visit that kind of balanced that out some, though.
We're more syncretist, or
well, I'm not going to say syncretist, but yeah. He implicitly scolded Christians in Europe and North America and told us to be less fearful of Islam.
Uh-huh.
And he made a somewhat flowery speech. I actually had ChatGPT find the quote for me. He said, "Dear friends, in your presence here today, in this extraordinary place where minarets and bell towers stand side by side, yet both soar toward the heavens, testifies to the enduring faith of this land and the persistent dedication of its people to the one God." So that was a very unifying message. I'm not going to say syncretistic.
No, it's not, right, but I see what you're saying.
And I recognize that in places where Muslims and Christians live side by side, we have to use very diplomatic language. And there's not only a spiritual aim, there's a socio-political aim. You want to mollify people and soothe tempers and all that sort of thing. But certainly there seems to be a kind of whiff of universalism there, indifferentism there, perhaps a little bit.
Okay. I see what you're saying. It's
the bell tower and the minaret. Yeah. Both praising God, kind of side by side in this beautiful place where we've learned to live as one and realize we just have the one God and kind of maybe like one religion, but maybe not.
I have to say the framing of being afraid of Muslims without saying, you know, things. I mean, maybe it's not right for him to say these other things, but, you know, millions of Christians have left Muslim countries in the last century. Why? Why did that? Like, maybe just raise that question. Maybe raise the question about why there are no Christian church in Saudi Arabia.
Millions of Muslims have moved into Europe and Australia, right? So just a little while ago, we had that awful shooting on Bondi Beach. And so
it seems a little pat just to say, why are you afraid of Muslims?
I mean, be less fearful. I mean, there's a very material reason, historically and in the present, for Christendom to fear certainly the militancy of Islam and to fear the cultural impact of large-scale immigration. And Pope Benedict warned about this, and other good churchmen have warned about this. Cardinal Mueller, to this day, talks about it. The lack of assimilation into Western Christian culture or not enough of it.
The active opposition to Western Christian, it's not just like a cat, like it's there's an actual, at least from what I hear in places like London, there is a determination not to assimilate. There's an expectation of victory.
And also Dearborn, Michigan now, and that whole area. It's there, it's happening in the States too, not just in London and Australia.
Right, and I don't doubt that 90% of the Muslim people on this earth are exactly what everybody always says Muslims are: peaceful, good, generous, family people, and all of that. But there's more than a billion Muslims on the earth. 10% jihadis is really bad, and I don't like to fail to talk about the jihadis, to fail to talk about what has happened with Wahhabism and the rise of violent Islam. What are we doing? Why do we have to pretend happening?
That 10% of jihadis are morally supported by perhaps 50% of the peaceful ones who may not commit any acts of violence themselves. But we see this. You mentioned London, Scandinavia, France, where
Nigeria.
Muslim population. Well, Nigeria, of course, is this whole other thing.
Okay,
but
fair
enough.
But
in Christendom, in European Christendom, where you have these whole sections of cities that have been called no-go zones. It's become a...
Is that real? I never know if that's real. Like, is that real?
It gets poo-pooed by revisionists.
Okay, because I haven't been there, so I don't know. But
I read a great phrase that's replacing it. Something like negotiated law enforcement, where the police know they leave certain segments of London or Paris or Stockholm alone because the majority Muslim population, most of them not people who are going to shoot you, but still are maybe fellow travelers to a degree, they've got their own set of laws. They've got their own way of dealing with crime, with morals in their locations.
But this attitude is going to lead to the overthrow of governments in Europe. I mean, their own people are going to throw them out if they continue this. Don't you think? I mean, like we hear about Geert Wilders, and who I think has been less than successful as a leader, but the message I just think there's a certain kind of lying to ourselves about what Wahhabism is, and the fact that it's persistent and determined and is thinking in terms of centuries and is violent. That if there was a political ideology, not a religious ideology, but just a pure political ideology that had the same strategic patience and willingness to use violence, we'd go, oh my gosh, this is a horrible threat. But because it's religious, we act like, well, you can't say anything about it.
Well, what does that sound like? A ideology that thinks in centuries, that is capable of using violence, that slowly subverts the thinking of a place. Does that remind you of another ideology? I think it sounds very much like Marxism. And in fact, we just ran an excellent article by a convert from Islam on Catholic.com about the affinities between Islamism as an ideology,
right,
and communism, and it's really eye opening.
I'm going to have to read that. I'm sorry that I missed that one.
Oh, it's excellent.
But I will read that. That's on what would the website be? I would go to read that.
www.catholic.com.
Catholic.com.
You missed
one W. Does he have to say the WW part? Does that
well, the fact that you said WW and you missed the third one, so you missed that part.
That makes it even better.
And you didn't even have to say it in the first place.
Can we fix that in post? Can we throw another W in there?
Bender, do your magic.
I do think, however, Pope's visiting places like Turkey and Lebanon, especially Lebanon, which has a huge Christian population, it's important for them to make these visits, and I'm glad that Pope Leo did it.
Can we shift to the other part of his visit there, the visit?
To Nicaea.
To Nicaea.
Please say something about that.
1,700 years later, they met at the location of the Council of Nicaea, and they prayed the Nicene Constantinopolitan Creed.
Constantinopolitan.
The Nicene Creed. They both prayed the Nicene Creed together. And I don't know. I know that...
You're talking about, but when you say both, Catholics and Orthodox
So the Patriarch, Bartholomew the First, I believe, is it? Or Bartholomew.
It's my favorite Bartholomew.
And Pope Leo together prayed the Nicene Creed together. And that, even though we are not fully unified, we both still have the sacraments. And of course, there's differences there that people are going to argue. And Ortho Bros Online hated the fact that that Pope Leo was there praying with Bartholomew. I think it was a great moment.
It's beautiful, though. I mean, 1,700 years to be standing on the very place where the creed that has held the church together and even now holds the church together. It's beautiful to think about that.
Yeah.
It's them standing in the ruins of that basilica. Well, why is it ruins again? I'm sorry. that is beautiful. Are you a pro or are you in favor or against the Nicene Creed? I just wanted to know where you come down.
The creed itself. Do you know I'm an editor, so I'd probably change a few things here and there, but by and large, it's okay.
Wait. What might you change?
There's a few comma splices in there and a few passive constructions, but that's okay.
All right. Well, I wonder why the passive constructions. Were they avoiding conflict on something? Because usually you're avoiding conflict.
Could have just been a bad translator. I don't know.
It could be. Yeah. It could be. All right. We didn't get to the number one story, and thank goodness, because I needed to tease to keep you for the next few minutes. We're going to take a very quick break shortly. And then we will come back with the number one Catholic news story of 2025. We will discuss it in depth. If you can guess what it is, between now and the time we come back, the number one Catholic news story of the year, you are average. Because everyone should be able to guess what the there should be absolutely no surprise at this. If you cannot guess it, you have a problem. Something's wrong. You have not been paying attention in 2025. Maybe, perhaps, you were away and no one has informed you, but we'll talk about that big story with the director of publishing here at Catholic Answers, Todd Aglialoro, and with the assistant to the host, Edgar Lueno, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.